chapter 37, Testimony for the Church. I have been shown that Satan has not been stupid and careless these many years since his fall, but has been learning. He has grown more artful. His plans are laid deeper and are more covered with a religious garment to hide their deformity. The power of Satan now to tempt and deceive is tenfold greater than it was in the days of the apostles. His power has increased and it will increase until it is taken away. His wrath and hate grow stronger as his time to work draws near its close. God knows how Satan is working and sends his angels to watch over his children to protect them from the devil's power. And the battle is constantly going on between the angels of God and the devil's angels. The angels of God are clothed with a complete armor, the panoply of heaven, and although surrounded with deadly foes, fear nothing, for they are doing the will of their love commander. They enter the darkest places to rescue the children of God from the snares of Satan, and their presence causes the evil angels to fall back. And as the evil angels are defeated, they utter terrible imprecations against the injustice of God and against his angels. I saw that the angels of God are not to force or bend the will of the individual they watch over. They are to gently chide, warn, and guard. Satan can never force back these holy angels from their charge. None can do this but the individuals that they are watching over. If these individuals continue to grieve these tender holy angels, if they go astray from their counsel and warnings and choose an independent course of their own, they will drive these angels from them. If the will is submitted to them, they will bend it in the heavenly channel, and they will ever be on the watch for their interest, leading them from a thousand dangers, preventing their lives being taken by Satan, and if they are inclined to go a wrong course, stand in the way before them to prevent their ruin. But if individuals continue to retain their own will, choose their own course, and have their own way, the angels leave them in sadness. Then Satan comes in to control the will and bend the mind and smiles in hellish triumph at his success. I saw that the great condescension for man has been made. Satan condescended to the shameful death of the cross, and now man, in his turn, must condescend and bow. He must yield up his will and pleasure if he would follow in the only road to heaven. I saw that God would not compel any to be saved. Jesus has made the great sacrifice, and if man will freely, gladly accept it, if he will choose life, he can have it. But his life must be one of continual yielding. I was pointed back and saw the condition of God's people in 1844. Then God was pleased with them and his love rested upon them. I was carried down still further and saw that they were not as devoted. Instead of going on from strength to strength, they have been growing weaker. They do not possess living faith. Their fruits are not such as will please God. A stupid indifference hangs upon them. They lack fervent piety. They manifest but very little melting love for Jesus and warm affection for their brethren. And I saw what God marked above everything else was their contented state. They have the truth. None can successfully oppose, and they enjoy it as if the Savior had no work for them to do in the salvation of souls. They comfort themselves that they are safe and leave the work of the Lord to others, and by degrees they relax their efforts and fall into an indifferent formal state. There are souls to save all around them, but they leave that for their ministers, and they have lost their activity and zeal and their patience in seeking to lead others to the truth. Many I saw had become weary of well-doing. They are shut up to themselves and seek to shun burdens. They fold their hands in peace at home as though they had no part to act in the advancement of the work of God. I saw the great lack of nursing fathers and mothers in Israel, and I saw why there are not more is because they will not take the burden and fill the place which God would be pleased to have them occupy. Self must be denied in order to fill this place. Earnest prayer and faithful watch care for others will take the place of ease and indifference. And often worldly interests will suffer a little. They may have to visit some brother or sister or some inquiring friend who needs help just when they wish to accomplish some worldly object. But if they lose a little of the earthly treasure here and do their master's will, they will lay up treasure in heaven. Their master, for their sake, became poor that they through his poverty might be made rich. I was shown that God would reward those who will bear responsibilities and with energy push his work forward and stand in the forefront of the battle. God will choose those who will venture something in his work, but there are those who will not fill the place that God would be pleased to have them fill. I saw that God had made my husband a burden bearer since 1844, that he might obtain an experience to fill the place in the work he designed for him to occupy. In order to do this, he has had to take responsibilities and to risk something in the success of this message. God would be pleased if others would feel the same interest and move with the same energy, but many will not venture. I saw that God was displeased with those who do not take the burden themselves and then stand ready to murmur at the one upon whom he lays the heavy burden. If others would come up and bear the burden he has borne for years and venture all, life, health, strength, time, everything, to push this work ahead, trusting alone to the success of the message, then God would release him from such heavy responsibilities. I saw that the blessing of the Lord has rested upon every essential move that has been made to advance his cause, and steadily has the work progressed. One difficulty after another has been surmounted. It is because God's hand was in the work. I saw that some do not realize that selfishness is at the bottom of their murmuring. God's humble instrument moves too fast for their faith, and his venturing out, as he has done, has reproved their slow and unbelieving pace, and there has been satisfaction taken in watching and finding fault. Hints have been thrown out, doubts expressed, which have had their influence. Their faith was not strong enough to keep pace with him. Had they possessed that strong faith and self-denial which they should have had, those who have the ability and means might do much in stirring up the people of God, and if they would venture out and risk something on the result and success of this message, it would inspire faith in the hearts of the remnant, and there would be activity and zeal in pushing forward this great work. I was shown that the work was not left in the hands of anyone upon earth. Angels of God have charge of the work, and they counsel and direct God's people through chosen agents, and thus the work moves forward. I was shown that God, in his own wise providence, raised my husband above dependence and want, that his testimony and influence might not be crippled by the galling sense of dependence. God will use him as his instrument to speak with freedom, independent of man, and in his strength raise his voice and with his example call upon the people to arouse and assist with their substance in moving forward this great work. And any that wish to be convinced can be that it is not selfishness nor to obtain any advantage himself that he pursues this course, but his object is to advance the work of God, which is dearer to him than life. I saw that it was easier for those who look on to complain and find fault than to suggest and lead in a better course. It is very easy and cheap to suggest doubts and fears, but it is not so readily undertaken to tell what shall be done. I was pointed back and saw that amid all the hatred and devices of Satan, God had spared the life of my husband, although Satan pressed him sore to take it away a few years since. The Lord wrenched him from the enemy's power and raised him up to still act for him, to walk out on his faith, to be a succorer to the needy, and to strengthen and uphold his servants whom he has called into the field. I saw that God had stayed him on the right hand and on the left, that he should not go to extremes. This has not been the work of man, but the mark of God's hand is seen in it. His work will go forward. Simple instruments God will choose to carry forward this great work, to carry out the mind and will of the great master at the head of the work. By some there is a shunning of the living testimony. Cutting truths must not be shunned. It needs something besides theory to reach hearts now. It needs the stirring testimony to alarm and arouse. That will stir the enemy's subjects, and then honest souls will be led to decide for the truth. There has been and still is with some a disposition to have everything move on very smoothly. They see no necessity of straight testimony. Sins exist in the church that God hates, but they are scarcely touched for fear of making enemies. Opposition has risen in the church to the plain testimony. Some will not bear it. They wish smooth things spoken unto them, and if the wrongs of individuals are touched, they complain of severity and sympathize with those in the wrong. As Ahab inquired of Elijah, "Art thou he that troubleth Israel?" They are ready to look with suspicion and doubt upon those who bear the plain testimony, and like Ahab, overlook the wrong which made it necessary for reproof and rebuke. When the church depart from God, they despise the plain testimony and complain of severity and harshness. It is a sad evidence of the lukewarm state of the church. Just as long as God has a church, He will have those who will cry aloud and spare not, who will be His instruments to reprove selfishness and sins, and will not shun to declare the whole counsel of God, whether men will hear or forbear. I saw that individuals would rise up against the plain testimonies. It does not suit their natural feelings. They would choose to have smooth things spoken unto them and have peace cried in their ears. I view the church in a more dangerous condition than they ever have been. Experimental religion is known by but few. The shaking must soon take place to purify the church. Preachers should have no scruples to preach the truth as it is found in God's Word. Let the truth cut. I have been shown that why the ministers have not more success is they are afraid of hurting feelings, fearful of not being courteous, and they lower the standard of truth and conceal, if possible, the peculiarity of our faith. I saw that God could not make such successful. The truth must be made pointed, and the necessity of a decision urged. And as false shepherds are crying peace and are preaching smooth things, the servants of God must cry aloud and spare not, and leave the result with God. God has given His servants the present truth so clear and plain that their opponents cannot stand before them. This great blessing, I have seen, has not been realized and prized. Some who are laboring in the cause of God have had so few privations, known so little of want or wearing labor or burden of soul, that when they have an easy time, they know it not and think their trials great. I saw that unless such have a spirit of self-sacrifice and are ready to labor cheerfully, not sparing themselves, God will release them. Some of the servants of God have given up their lives to spend and be spent for the cause of God. They are almost worn out with mental labor, incessant care, toil, and privations. Others have not had and would not take the burdens upon them. Yet just such ones think they have a hard time because they never have experienced hardships. They never have been baptized into the suffering part, and never will be as long as they manifest so little fortitude and love their ease so well. Let these servants feel the woe upon them if they preach not the gospel, and it will be enough. Could some be placed back 10 or 12 years and labor through the discouragements that then existed? They would find a great change in the labor now compared with what it was then. Then the friends of the cause were few, their means limited, and it was a constant battle against error and fanaticism. Privations and want were then endured by God's servants without murmuring. I have had more fears for our preachers now than ever before. A laborer in the gospel field will feel a burden for souls if he fills the place God designs him to fill. He will labor in the desk and out of it. While at the fireside, he will enter into the feelings of those who have listened to solemn, important truths from his lips. He will watch for souls as one that must give an account. Sabbath keepers, remember that the outside appearance is an index to the heart. And while you are so anxious to imitate the fashions of the world, while your heart is in these things, you are like them. You have their spirit and have lost the truth out of your heart. While you study your appearance to look as near like the world as possible, remember your Redeemer. Upon His head was a crown of thorns. The greatest concern some Sabbath keepers have is their outward appearance. They are fostering pride and will perish with their pride unless they entirely reform. They make vain excuses for wearing hoops. They cannot endure the idea of being peculiar. I saw that Sabbath keepers should not give the least influence to a fashion carried to such a ridiculous length. But while some are following the fashion and manifest so much pride about their appearance, some others take the other extreme and dress odd and slack and destroy the influence they might have with unbelievers. Some hold themselves in a position to watch the dress of others and find fault with every article they think not just right. If a sister is dressed orderly and taste is manifested in her dress, the trial is raised, the sister is proud. I saw that some are withering spiritually. They have been watching for every fault to make trouble with. They neglect their own souls. They seldom see or feel their own faults, for they have had all they could do to watch the faults of others. A dress, a bonnet, an apron takes their attention. They must talk with this one and that one about the matter, and it is sufficient for them to dwell upon for weeks. All the religion a few poor souls have is to watch the garments and acts of others and find fault with them. Unless they reform, there will be no place in heaven for them, for with this spirit they would find fault with Jesus and angels. Some who are very careless in their dwellings and of their persons consider it pride to be neat and are tried with those who are neat and cleanly. I saw that neatness and order in dress and cleanliness throughout the dwelling should be strictly observed by Sabbath keepers who are looked upon as strange and are watched for their faults. Their influence should be holy. The sacred truths which we profess will never degrade the receivers and make them coarse and rough, neglectful of their persons and untidy in their houses. If the receiver has slack habits, the truth elevates him and works for him a thorough reformation. Unless the truth has this effect, the individual has not felt its saving power. A careless and disordered dress is no mark of humility. Here some have deceived themselves. The life, the acts, the words will tell whether the individual possesses true humility, and the dress will correspond with the fruits manifested. A pure fountain cannot send forth sweet water and bitter. Cleanse the fountain and the streams will be pure. The house of God is often desecrated by Sabbath keepers' children. Their parents allow them to run about the house, play, talk, take the attention of the people, and manifest their evil tempers in the very meetings where they have assembled to worship God. I have seen that in the assembly of the saints a holy stillness should reign, but the house where God's people assemble is often made a perfect Babylon, a place of confusion and disorder. This is displeasing to God. If the parents have not government and cannot control their children in meeting, God would be better pleased for them to remain at home with their unruly children. They had better suffer the loss of meetings than to have a large number annoyed and their meetings spoiled. If parents leave their children uncontrolled, unsubdued at home, they cannot have them do as they wish in meeting. Who should be the sufferers in this case? Certainly the parents. They should not feel afflicted if others do not wish to have their peace disturbed when they meet to worship God. Parents, you must be the sufferers in this matter, and it may lead you to see and fulfill your neglected duty. If you carry your children to the house of God, they should be made to understand that they are where God meets with His people. There is not that order observed among Sabbath keepers in this respect that there is in the nominal churches. Parents, you have a work to do. Subdue your children at home, and then you can govern them in the house of God. The Lord has shown me that His grace is sufficient for all our trials, and although they are greater than ever before, yet if we trust wholly in God, we can overcome every temptation and through His grace come off victorious. If we overcome our trials and obtain victory over the temptations of Satan, then we can endure the trial of our faith, which is much more precious than gold, and are stronger and better prepared to meet the next. But if we sink down and give way to the temptations of Satan, we get no reward for the trial and shall not be so well prepared for the next. In this way we shall grow weaker and weaker until we are led captive by Satan at his will. When temptations and trials rush in upon us, let us go to God and agonize with him in prayer. He will give us grace and strength to overcome and break the power of the enemy. God has shown me that he gives his people a bitter cup to drink to purify and cleanse them. They can make it still more bitter by murmuring, complaining, and repining. But those who receive it thus must have another draught, for the first does not have its designed effect upon the heart. And if the second does not affect the work, then they must have another and another, until it does have its designed effect, or they will be left impure in heart. I saw that this bitter cup can be sweetened by patience, endurance, and prayer, and that it will have its designed effect upon the hearts of those who thus receive it, and God will be honored and glorified. I have frequently seen that the children of the Lord neglect prayer, especially in secret, and that many do not exercise that faith which is their privilege and duty, and often wait for that feeling which faith alone can bring. Feeling is not faith, but the two are distinct. Faith is ours to exercise, but the blessing is God's to give. The grace of God comes to the soul through the channel of living faith, and that faith it is our power to exercise. True faith lays hold of and claims a promised blessing before it is realized and felt. I have seen that we must send up our petitions in faith within the second veil and take hold of the promised blessing and claim it as ours. And we are then to believe that the blessing is ours and that we receive it because our faith has hold of it, and according to the word it is ours. What things soever ye desire when ye pray, believe that ye receive them, and ye shall have them. Here is faith, naked faith, to believe that we receive the blessing even before we realize it. When the promised blessing is realized and enjoyed, faith is swallowed up. But many suppose they have much faith when sharing largely of the Holy Spirit, and that they cannot have faith unless they feel the power of the Spirit. Such confound faith with the blessing that comes through faith. The very time to exercise faith is when we feel destitute of the Spirit. When thick clouds of darkness seem to hover over the mind, then is the time to let living faith pierce the darkness and scatter the clouds. True faith rests on the promises contained in the Word of God, and those only who obey the Word can claim the glorious promises contained in it. If ye abide in me, and my words abide in you, ye shall ask what ye will, and it shall be done unto you. John 15:7. Whatsoever we ask, we receive of him, because we keep his commandments and do those things that are pleasing in his sight. 1 John 3:22. As inquiries are frequently made as to my state and vision, and after I come out, I would say that when the Lord sees fit to give a vision, I am taken into the presence of Jesus and angels and am entirely lost to earthly things. I can see no farther than the angel directs me. My attention is often directed to scenes transpiring upon earth. At times I am carried far ahead into the future and shown what is to take place. Then again I am shown things that, as they have occurred in the past. After I come out of vision, I do not at once remember all that I have seen, and the matter is not so clear before me until I write. Then the scene rises before me as was presented in vision, and I can write with freedom. Sometimes the things which I have seen are hid from me after I come out of vision, and I cannot call them to mind until I am brought before a company where the vision applies. Then the things which I have seen come to my mind with force. I am just as dependent upon the Spirit of the Lord in relating or writing a vision as in having the vision. It is impossible for me to call up things which have been shown me unless the Lord brings them before me at the time that he is pleased to have me relate or write them. It has been a matter of great perplexity to me to know what course to pursue with messages given me for individuals. I have often written messages of reproof for different ones and given them to these persons, and they have laid them away and have said nothing about them. Their course is shown in many instances that they were not affected by the messages, and they have continued to have a bad influence in the church who were ignorant of the reproof given. My course is now clear to wrong the church no longer. If reproofs are given, I dare not commit them alone to the individuals to be buried up by them, but shall read them what the Lord has seen fit to give me to those of experience in the church, and if the case demands, bring it before the whole church. The great delicacy which some have manifested, lest others should learn that they have been reproved, proceeds from a lack of humility and unwillingness to acknowledge their wrongs. The minds of many have been abused by individuals that have been reproved by vision, and their minds prejudiced because they had no knowledge of what the Lord had revealed. I shall keep these things secret no longer. God's people must know what the Lord has been pleased to reveal, that they may not be deceived and led astray by a wrong spirit. Testimonies. In bearing the testimony which the Lord has given me for the last 15 years, I have been opposed by many who became my bitter enemies, especially those whose errors and sins have been revealed to me and have been exposed by me. Some of these have carried out their feelings of revenge, as might be expected, in attacking the humble instrument and circulating unfavorable reports against me. As these things have troubled some who have had no knowledge of my early experiences, my brethren and sisters who have known my experience and labors for the last 10 or 15 years have put into my hands their testimonies for me to use when necessary. These have been a benefit to me the past 2 years and probably will be in the future. One instance I will mention. At the time of the Cranes Grove, Illinois conference and discussion, several of the age to come No Sabbath preachers designed to bring out before the public some of the reports in circulation. But when they learned that we were prepared for them, Elder Stevenson stated to my husband that they had concluded to do nothing about it. I will here give two of these testimonies, also some others, which have been sent to me by those who have read the printed sheets of this book. And I would here state to all others who can freely and cheerfully give their names to these testimonies to send them in immediately. Also, those who can testify to other facts stated in this book will please send their testimonies with the names of as many as can cheerfully give them. There will be but 400 copies of the last 16 pages of this book printed now. These will be sent out, and when all have sent in their testimonies and names, who would esteem it a pleasure, the entire edition will be completed. A special request is made that if any find incorrect statements in this book, they will immediately inform me. The edition will be completed about the 1st of October, therefore send before that time. Ellen G. White. Note, the following further account of experiences written after the issuance of the first limited printing of Spiritual Gifts, Volume 2, on September 18, 1860, was included in subsequent editions. It appears here that the reader may have all that was published in all the writings. Trustees of the Ellen G. White Publications. September 20, 1860, my fourth child, John Herbert White, was born. When he was 3 weeks old, my husband felt it to be his duty to travel west. About 1 week before he was to visit Mauston, we received letters from MES for publication, purporting to be visions given her of the Lord. As we read these communications, we felt distressed. We knew that they were not from the right source, and as my husband knew nothing of what he was about to meet at Mauston, we feared that he would be unprepared to meet the fanaticism and that it would have a discouraging influence upon his mind. We had passed through so many such scenes in our early experience and had suffered so much from these unruly, untamable spirits that we have dreaded to be brought in contact with them. I sent in a request for the church at Battle Creek to pray for my husband, and at our family altar we earnestly sought the Lord. With brokenness of spirit and many tears, we tried to fasten our trembling faith upon God's promises, and we had the evidence that God heard us pray and that He would stand by my husband and impart to him counsel and wisdom. While looking in the Bible for a verse for Willie to commit to memory to repeat in the Sabbath school, these words arrested my attention. The Lord is good, a stronghold in the time of trouble, and He knoweth them that trust in Him. I could but weep over these words. They seemed so appropriate. The whole burden upon my mind was for my husband and the church in Wisconsin. My husband realized the blessing of God while in Wisconsin. The Lord was to him a stronghold in time of trouble. He sustained him while he bore a decided testimony against the wild fanaticism there and upheld him by his free spirit. I received a letter from my husband written at Mackford, Wisconsin, which he stated, "I fear that all is not well at home. I have had some impressions as to the babe. While praying for the family at home, he had a presentiment that the child was very sick. The babe seemed lying before him with face and head dreadfully swollen. When I received the letter, the babe was as well as usual, but the next morning he was taken very sick. It was an extreme case of erysipelas in the face and head. When my husband reached Brother Wick's near Round Grove, Illinois, the telegraphic dispatch stating the sickness of the child was handed him, and as he read, he stated to those present that he was prepared for the news, for the Lord had prepared his mind for it, and that they would hear that the child's head and face were greatly affected. The dear babe was a great sufferer. 24 days and nights we anxiously watched over him, using all the remedies we could for his recovery, and earnestly presenting his case to the Lord. At times I could not control my feelings as I witnessed his sufferings. Much of my time was spent in tears and humble supplication to God, but our Heavenly Father saw fit to remove my lovely babe. December 14, I was called up. My babe was worse. I listened to his labored breathing and felt his pulseless wrist. I knew that he must die. That was an hour of anguish for me. The icy hand of death was already upon him. We watched his feeble, gasping breath until it ceased, and we felt thankful that his sufferings were ended. When my child was dying, I could not weep. I fainted at the funeral. My heart ached as though it would break, yet I could not shed a tear. We were disappointed in not having Brother Loughborough to conduct the funeral services, and my husband spoke upon the occasion to a crowded house. We followed our child to Oak Hill Cemetery, there to rest until the life-giver shall come and break the fetters of the tomb and call him forth immortal. After we returned from the funeral, my home seemed lonely. I felt reconciled to the will of God, yet despondency and gloom settled upon me. The discouragements brought upon us the past summer we could not rise above. As to the state of God's people, we knew not what we might expect. Satan had controlled the minds of some closely connected with us in the work, even some who had been acquainted with our mission and seen the fruits of our labors, and have not only witnessed the manifestations of the power of God many times, but had felt its influence upon their own bodies. What could we hope for in the future? While my child lived, I thought I understood my duty. I pressed my dear babe to my heart and rejoiced that at least for one winter I should be released from any great responsibility, for it could not be my duty to travel in winter with my infant. But when he was taken from me, I was again thrown into great perplexity. The condition of the cause and the state of God's people nearly crushed us. Our happiness has depended upon the state of the cause of God. When God's people are in a prospering condition, we feel free. But when they are in disorder and backslidden, nothing can make us joyful. Our whole interest in life has been interwoven with the rise and progress of the third angel's message. We are bound up in it, and when it does not prosper, we experience great suffering of mind. About this time, my husband, as he reviewed the past, began to lose confidence in almost everybody. Many of those he had tried to befriend had acted the part of enemies, and some that he had helped the most with his own scanty purse and his influence with others had been putting forth a perpetual effort to injure him and cast burdens upon him. One Sabbath morning, as he was going to our place of worship, an overpowering sense of such injustice came over him, and he turned aside to weep aloud while the congregation waited for him. From the commencement of our labors, we have been called to bear a plain, pointed testimony, to reprove wrongs and spare not. And all the way there have been those who have stood in opposition to our testimony and have followed after to speak smooth things, daub with untempered mortar, and destroy the influence of our labors. The Lord would rein us up to bear reproof, and then individuals have stepped right in between us and the people to make our testimony of none effect. Many visions have been given that we must occupy the position to stir up the people of God and not shun to declare His counsel, for the church was asleep in their sins. But few have sympathized with us, while many have sympathized with the wrong and with those who have been reproved. These things crushed us, and we felt that we had no testimony to bear in the church. We knew not who to confide in. All these things forced themselves upon us, and hope died within us. We retired to rest about midnight, but I could not sleep. A severe pain was in my heart, and I could find no relief. I fainted a number of times. My husband sent for Brethren C. Smith, Amidon, and Kellogg. Their fervent prayers were heard, relief came, and I was taken off in vision. Then I was shown that we must still bear our testimony straight and pointed, that we had a work to do. Then the individuals were presented before me who have shunned the pointed testimony. I saw the influence of their teachings upon God's people. I was shown the condition of the people in blank, blank. They have the theory of truth but are not sanctified through it. I saw that when the messengers enter a new place, their labor is worse than lost unless they bear a plain, pointed testimony. They should keep up the distinction between the Church of Jesus Christ and formal dead professors. There was a failure in blank. Brother Blank was fearful of offending, fearful lest the peculiarities of our faith should appear and the standard was lowered down to the people. The fact should have stood out living before the people that we possess truths of vital importance and that their eternal interest depended upon the decision they would make. And in order to be sanctified through the truth, their idols must be given up, their sins be confessed, and they bring forth fruit meet for repentance. Those who engage in the solemn work of bearing the third angel's message must move out decidedly and in the spirit and power of God, fearlessly preach the truth and let it cut. They should elevate the standard of truth and urge the people to come up to it. It has been lowered down to meet the people in their condition of darkness and sin. It is the pointed testimony that will bring up the people to decide. A peaceful testimony will not do this. The people have the privilege of listening to this kind of teaching from the pulpits of the day. But God has servants to whom He has entrusted a solemn, fearful message to bring out and fit up a people for the coming of Christ. There is a great difference in our faith and that of nominal professors, as the heavens are higher than the earth. The people are asleep in their sins and need to be alarmed before they can shake off this lethargy. Their ministers have preached smooth things. God's servants who bear sacred vital truths should cry aloud and spare not, that the truth may tear off the garment of security and find its way to the heart. The straight testimony that the people in blank should have had was walked all around, and the seed of truth was sown among thorns and has been choked by the thorns. God's servants must bear a pointed testimony. It will cut the natural heart and develop character. Brethren Blank and Blank moved with a perfect restraint upon them while in blank. Such preaching will never do the work that God designs to have accomplished. There is enough scringing and crippling and wrapping up pointed truths which rebuke sin by the ministers of the nominal churches. Unless souls embrace the message aright and their hearts are prepared to receive it, they had better let it entirely alone. In view of the slanderous report circulated by a few individuals against Brother and Sister White, we feel called upon to testify that we have been personally acquainted with them and their course since 1844, and therefore know that any statements that would represent them as being in any wise connected with or countenancing to any degree those fanatical abominations into which some in Maine and elsewhere were drawn during the years 1844 to 1846 are wicked and malicious falsehoods. We have never known them to be in the least infected with the spirit or works of fanaticism, but on the contrary, as the untiring and unflinching opposers of the same. Signed, H.N. Smith, S.B. Belden, Edward Andrews, S.L. Andrews, A.S. Andrews, Cyprian Stevens, Almira T. Stevens, Pauline R. Stevens, F.J. Stevens, Stockbridge Howland, L.M. Howland, F.H. Howland, R.D. Howland, M.R. Adderton, George Cobb, Louis O. Stoll, Laura T. Stoll, Louis B. Stoll, Marion C. Stoll, Sarah H. Stoll, N.N. Lunt, S.H. Lunt, R.D. Waterman, D.H. Wright, Thomas Worcester, Lydia Bolton, P.A. Gammon, Abram Barnes, and S.W. Flanders. Portland, Maine, August 10, 1858. As unfavorable reports are in circulation against Elder James White and wife, it is a pleasure to us to testify that we have been personally acquainted with them since 1844. They have had no sympathy with the no-work theory, voluntary humility, spiritual second advent, and spiritual union, not in accordance with the law of marriage, but ever raised their voices against these different forms of fanaticism which prevailed with some in New England. N.N. Lunt, Jacob Mills, Dorcas Wright, Elizabeth Haynes, S.H. Lunt, Thomas Worcester, Phoebe A. Gammon, Isaiah Libby. We bear cheerful testimony to the truthfulness of the statements relative to Elder Damon on page 40 and 41. As near as we can recollect, we believe the circumstances of his arrest and trial to be fairly stated. William T. Hannaford, James Ayer, Sr., H.A. Hannaford, D.S. Hannaford, Mrs. R.W. Wood. Topsham, Maine, August 6, 1860. The wonderful manifestation of the power of God in healing Sister Frances Howland is correctly stated on pages 42 to 44, except the one who baptized her. Stockbridge Howland, L.M. Howland, F.H. Howland, R.D. Howland. In our opinion, Sister White has given a fair statement of the fanaticism in Maine and her labors with the unfortunate victims of it in pages 49 to 65. Edward Andrews, S.L. Andrews, A.S. Andrews, Almira T. Stevens, P.R. Stevens, F.J. Stevens, J.G. Foy, George Cobb, Stockbridge Howland, L.M. Howland, F.H. Howland, R.D. Howland, Abram Barnes, S.W. Flanders, and H.N. Smith.